Hello and welcome to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Thursday, May 15th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, John Elmer, Asa Wynn Stanley, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 587 of the genocide in Gaza. Today is also Nakba Day, a day of mourning and the commemoration of the forced expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland in 1948. 77 years ago, when Israel declared itself a state in historic Palestine. We'll have more on Nakba Day later on. Coming up, as Gaza's population faces starvation and ceaseless, horrific massacres, we speak with Asim al-Nabi. He serves as the spokesperson for the Gaza City municipality, and he's also a regular contributor to the Electronic Intifada. And while Israel is perpetrating the genocide, it cannot carry it out alone. We will also speak to several Microsoft employees who are organizing against the company's role in Israel's mass slaughter in Gaza and who have paid for their principles by losing their jobs. Later on in the program, John will bring us the latest resistance news from Gaza and break down the Qassam Brigade's series of ambushes in Rafah, dubbed the Gates of Hell. But first, let's take a look at the news. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. In Gaza, Israel has accelerated its attacks on Palestinians, massacring dozens of people each day in tent shelters, in schools turned into housing for displaced families, in residential buildings, and inside two hospitals. U.S. President Donald Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, said he is hopeful that a ceasefire deal can be reached after yet more talks in Doha with Qatari officials, but of course no further details have been revealed. However, Israeli Prime Minister and war crimes fugitive Benjamin Netanyahu declared that even if captured, Israeli soldiers are released under the terms of a ceasefire, he is still intent on escalating attacks and, quote, destroying Hamas. He said, quote, we'll take them, meaning the Israeli captives, and then we'll go in. There will be no way we will stop the war. Netanyahu boasted to lawmakers in the Knesset's Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee that the Israeli army is, quote, destroying more and more houses in Gaza, and that Palestinians have nowhere to return. The only obvious result will be Gazans choosing to emigrate outside of the Strip, Netanyahu continued, but our main problem is finding countries to take them in. Since Israel broke the ceasefire on March 18th, the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza says that more than 2,800 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 8,000 have been injured. The ministry states that as of May 14th, approximately 53,000 Palestinians have been killed since October 7th, 2023, with thousands more missing and buried under the rubble. As of airtime today, Thursday, May 15th, at least 100 people have been killed in airstrikes on homes and tent shelters since dawn in Jabalia, Khan Yunis, Maghazi refugee camp, and Al Mawasi. On Wednesday, May 14th, the Israeli army spokesperson issued forced displacement orders for Palestinians in Gaza City, including yet another order to empty Al-Shifa Hospital. The spokesperson said the military planned to attack, quote, with great force. The Israeli military had already killed more than 80 Palestinians since dawn on Wednesday, including approximately 50 killed in Jabalia in northern Gaza. Al Jazeera's reporter Tarek Abu Azoum stated that airstrikes targeted five residential buildings packed with civilians in Jabalia and the Jabalia refugee camp. Quote, civil defense teams reported that the scene of the attack was horrific. First-hand accounts say the Israeli army launched consecutive strikes without any prior warning and that many of the victims remain under the rubble. We continue to get testimonies saying the morgue of the Indonesian hospital has been flooded with bodies, Abu Azoum stated. Mohamed Awad, an emergency doctor in the Indonesian hospital, told Agence France-Presse that supply shortages meant his department could not properly handle the flow of wounded and that the, quote, Bodies of the martyrs are lying on the ground in the hospital corridors. There are not enough beds, no medicine, and no means for surgical or medical treatment, which leaves doctors unable to save many of the injured who are dying due to lack of care, he said. Jabalia has been under heavy bombardment all week. On Friday, May 9th, a United Nations aid distribution center that had also been sheltering displaced families was attacked, killing at least four Palestinians. On May 11th, Israel bombed the Fatima Bani Assad school that has been sheltering displaced families, killing at least 15 people. Journalist Mahmoud Abu Salama reported from the scene. He said that the Israeli military bombed the school, turning the site into widespread destruction. Quote, displaced people were sleeping, holding on to the hope of a ceasefire agreement, but Israeli airstrikes targeted them here without warning. Israeli gunboats fired on Gaza fishers on May 10th, injuring Palestinians trying to find any source of food for their families in the sea. On Tuesday, May 13th, Israel bombed two hospitals in Khan Yunis in the south, the European Gaza Hospital and the Nasser Medical Complex. Israel used bunker buster bombs and fire belts on the European Gaza Hospital, killing at least 28 Palestinians and wounding dozens in multiple strikes. Israeli media claimed without evidence that there were tunnels under the hospital and that Mohammed Sinwar, the military commander of the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, was the target of the attack. CCTV footage obtained by Al Jazeera showed the moment Israel bombed the courtyard of the hospital. Journalist Moaz Toha spoke to hospital staff and medical workers who showed massive pieces of shrapnel that tore through the facility. Both hospital staff and medical workers described shrapnel and the bombing ripping through emergency areas and damaging parts of the building. At least six people were martyred and more than 40 others injured. Attacks on the European Gaza Hospital continued on Wednesday, May 14th. Six consecutive airstrikes hit areas around the hospital compound, targeting a bulldozer that was working to clear rubble and recover bodies underneath from Tuesday's attacks. A doctor at the European Gaza Hospital, Adnan Issa, recorded this voice message for logistics coordinator Afif Nesouli, who works with the medical group GLIA in Gaza. Adnan Issa says that there was continuous bombing.
I'm stuck in the hospital right now, and really the situation is very bad, bad, bad. It's so bad. And really pray for me. And oh my God, a lot of bombing around my hospital and in my hospital. And that's very terrible thing.
As of today, Thursday, the European Gaza Hospital has been forced to close completely. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza says that Israel's attacks caused significant damage to infrastructure, including sewage lines, damage to internal departments, and destruction of roads leading to the hospital. And we'll have a full interview with GLIA's logistics coordinator, Afif Nesouli, coming up later this week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, where he speaks about the ongoing attacks on hospitals. Nasser Medical Complex, also in Khan Yunis, was bombed in the pre-dawn hours on Tuesday, May 13th, killing two Palestinians. 18 hospital beds in the surgical department, 8 beds in the intensive care unit, and 10 inpatient beds were also destroyed, according to medical sources. The attack was a targeted assassination of journalist Hassan Asleya, who was a contributor to local and international news outlets and was a prominent reporter in Gaza. Dropsite News says that Asleya's footage of airstrikes, raids, and the aftermath of civilian massacres was used by AP, CNN, Getty, Sky News, and the New York Times. In early April, Asleya was the intended target of a drone strike on a media tent outside the hospital. The strike killed reporter Ahmed Mansour, who was captured on video sitting in a chair with his head and chest on fire. Mansour died a few days later while receiving treatment in the intensive care unit. The Israeli army had accused Asleya of being affiliated with Hamas's armed wing and claimed that he had participated in the October 7th operation. Asleya, who was severely injured in the attack on the media tent, told Mondo Weiss 2 days after the attacks on April 9th that, quote, the occupation is trying to obliterate the image of Palestinian journalists with these false claims that they belong to Hamas and other factions. Anyone with even a passing knowledge of Hamas and how the Qassam brigades operate will instantly recognize how utterly incoherent the Israeli army's claims are, noted Mondo Weiss contributor Tarek Hajjaj, who profiled Hassan Asleya. But Israel is counting on people's ignorance and gullibility to believe that a dedicated journalist who operates in the field 24/7 also moonlights as a Hamas fighter. Asleya knew there was a target on his back. He told Mondo Weiss that, quote, it would not be difficult for the occupation to assassinate me again, especially with the increasing incitement I hear and see against me. They may target me inside the hospital, in this room of mine. What can I do? I am not fighting. I am working, and I bear responsibility for my profession, Hassan Asleya continued. If the Israeli army kills me, the photos I took and the stories I told the world will live on. My name, my cause, and my voice will live on, and the occupation will die. Journalist Ahmed Al-Najjar reported from Nasser Hospital on Wednesday.
The burns department inside Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, but as you can see, it is completely destroyed because the Israeli occupation's warplanes bombed it over the night, killing and assassinating one prominent Palestinian journalist here. Our colleague Hassan Asleya, one of the press prominent figures and pillars in the Gaza Strip, was assassinated here after almost over a month of another attempt of assassinating him right outside that hospital. It wasn't just Hassan who was receiving treatment here. It was him and dozens of the wounded people who sustained burns by the Israeli occupation's attack. And as you can see, everything here is destroyed. The beds, the medical equipment, everything here is destroyed following this lethal attack by the Israeli occupation, who continues to suppress and assassinate all those trying to show the truth and broadcast what is happening here to the world.
That was Ahmed Al-Najjar. The Gaza government media office says that Hassan Asleya, assassinated in his hospital bed at Nasser Medical Complex, was the 215th journalist and media worker in Gaza killed since October 2023. Condolences and condemnations over Asleya's assassination poured in from all across Gaza and around the world. There was a massive funeral procession in the streets in Khan Yunis for Hassan Asleya on Tuesday amidst the rubble. Also on Tuesday, Israeli forces shot and killed a 12-year-old boy, Mohammed al-Bardawil, in Al-Mawasi. The child, along with his father, Saeed, was an eyewitness to the massacre of paramedics and first responders in Rafah on March 23rd. As you'll remember, the Israeli army had ambushed a convoy of ambulances, executed the paramedics, and threw their bodies into a mass pit. They also buried the ambulances in the sand. The boy and his father were on their way to go fishing when they were detained by Israeli soldiers before the attack on March 23rd and were subsequently abducted. They were interviewed by the New York Times for its investigation into the massacre. A second round of testimonies was scheduled for Mohammed al-Bardawil to assist in an international commission on war crimes, with testimonies and evidence submitted to the UN office and the South African legal team at the International Court of Justice. But he was killed before he was able to provide further eyewitness testimony. More than 70 days have passed since Israel closed all the crossings into Gaza, creating mass starvation and an engineered medical catastrophe for Gaza's 2 million Palestinians. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza stated on May 11th that there is now a dangerous acceleration of a severe shortage of pharmaceutical supplies and that 43% of essential medicines are at zero stock. 64% of medical supplies are at zero stock, and emergency operating room and intensive care units are operating on depleted stocks, with critical cases on the rise. Since the aid blockade began on March 2nd, 57 children have reportedly died from the effects of malnutrition, according to the Ministry of Health. This number is likely an underestimate and is expected to increase. A new alert published on May 12th by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, the global standard for assessing food insecurity, says that starvation has reached unprecedented levels. The entire population of Gaza is now classified in emergency, with more than 71,000 children aged 6 months to 5 years old suffering from acute malnutrition, including more than 14,000 severe cases. The situation is growing equally dire for pregnant and breastfeeding women, with an estimated 18,000 women expected to require urgent treatment to avoid life-threatening and irreversible health consequences for both mothers and infants. Euromed Human Rights Monitor says a silent death is sweeping through Gaza's community of elders as well. Now entering its third consecutive month, the intensified siege has had devastating and long-term effects, disproportionately harming Gaza's most vulnerable, Euromed says. Israel's systematic policy seeks to destroy all means of survival and eliminate any path to staying alive. This deepens the humanitarian catastrophe, making it a central instrument in the execution of genocidal policy. Over the past week, 14 elderly Palestinians were documented to have died across Gaza from complications related to hunger, malnutrition, and lack of medical care. These deaths are directly linked to Israel's complete closure of border crossings and its prevention of humanitarian aid and essential goods from entering the Strip since March 2nd, the rights group stated. A proposed Israeli-American mechanism for humanitarian aid in Gaza, Euromed added, is nothing more than a new maneuver aimed at prolonging the illegal and comprehensive blockade. It repackages the crime of starvation in a misleading humanitarian guise, falsely legitimizing its continued use as a weapon in the ongoing crime of genocide. The aid agency Oxfam said this week that, quote, Gaza's starvation is not incidental. It is deliberate, entirely engineered, and has now created the largest population facing starvation anywhere in the world, a preventable famine unfolding in real time. It is unconscionable and is being allowed to happen. Furthermore, Oxfam stated, quote, Israel's plan to militarize the delivery of humanitarian aid, an egregious violation of international humanitarian law, threatens to push this already catastrophic crisis into full collapse. Turning aid into a tool of control endangers civilians, erodes the neutrality of humanitarian work, and risks unleashing even greater chaos and suffering across Gaza. Early this morning, May 15th, Israeli forces killed two more journalists in airstrikes on Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. The Gaza government media office stated that Ahmed Anwar Abdelhadi Al-Helou, who worked as an editor for the Quds News Network, and Hassan Marzouk Samour, who worked as a broadcaster and presenter for Sawat Al-Aqsa Radio, were killed along with their families in separate bombings. After Hassan Asleh's assassination, the Gaza government media office says that 217 journalists and media workers have been killed since October 2023. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight excerpts of A Long-Awaited Reunion in Amman by Khaled El-Hissi, writing from exile in Jordan. Khaled is one of our longtime contributors and is from Jabalia in northern Gaza. He has been receiving treatment for blood cancer in Amman, Jordan, for some time now and has written extensively about his friends and family in Gaza who have been killed or displaced. He wrote this week about meeting up with his good friend Abu Bakr Abed, who passed through Amman on his way to Ireland a few weeks ago. Khaled describes encountering Abu Bakr for the first time, both as university students at the Islamic University of Gaza in 2021, and how their friendship evolved and tightened over time, especially after the genocide began in 2023. Khaled writes that, quote, on April 17th, 2025, my sleep was fitful as my thoughts kept returning to my cousin Wasim al-Hissi, 10, who had been killed the day before when Israel bombed my cousin's family's home in Jabalia. Mohanned, 5, Khaula, 3, and Wasim were the children of my cousin Hamuda, a pet name for Muhammad. Mayar, just 2 months old, was the only daughter of my cousin Haytham. Israel killed them in an instant. My cousins later collected the remains of one of the children's intestines from a tree. After countless attempts at falling asleep, tossing in bed, staring at the ceiling, checking the time on my phone, moving to the couch, then back to bed again, I still couldn't quiet the jumble of thoughts crowding my mind. I was already exhausted. 2 days earlier, I had taken a dose of chemotherapy medication, and the side effects were brutal. I drifted off eventually, only to be woken at exactly 8:45 a.m. by two calls from a Jordanian number I didn't recognize. Half asleep, I squinted at the screen and muttered to myself, "Who's calling at this hour?" I didn't answer. I went back to sleep. I woke up around noon and decided to grab a falafel sandwich with some fava beans for breakfast from a nearby shop. At 1:20 p.m., while I was on my way, Abu Bakr messaged me, "Call me now, immediately." I thought something might have happened to him, or that he wanted to show me the field where he was working as a correspondent at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, as he often did. I tried calling, but the line didn't go through. A moment later, he called me instead. "How are you?" he asked. "I'm fine, but it's you who I should ask, how are you?" I replied. "I want to tell you something, but promise me you'll keep it a secret. Promise me," Abu Bakr said. "I promise," I replied. "I'm in Amman." "You're joking, Ya Rajul," I said, using the Arabic word for man, thinking he was messing with me. "Wallahi, I'm not joking," he said, swearing by God. "I'm really in Amman." Khaled writes that they immediately met up and had a tearful reunion. Abu Bakr tells him about the journey he took after leaving Gaza, the bus driving through historic Palestine, seeing it for the first time in his life. Abu Bakr, finishing his washing before prayers, tells Khaled, quote, "I'd give everything up just to take that journey again, to see Palestine again. Our country is the most beautiful in the world, and that's exactly why they've stolen it. I'm telling you, Khaled, once I finish my treatment here, I'm going back to Gaza. We all need to go back. Our country needs us." I cut in, "Me too. As soon as I finish my treatment, I'm going back, just like you. Gaza needs us, and not just Gaza, Khaled," he smiled, gently correcting me. "All of Palestine needs us." He looked at me, his voice steady. "We, the youth, are the ones who will liberate this land. No one else will do it for us. It's on us to free Palestine." Those are excerpts from A Long-Awaited Reunion in Amman by Khaled al-Hissi on electronicintifada.net. Turning quickly to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces on Wednesday demolished more homes in the Nur Shams refugee camp in the northern city of Tul Karem, as the military aggression on the camp entered the 95th day, according to local news. Wafa news agency said that Israeli bulldozers tore down residential buildings in the vicinity of the Abu Bakr as-Siddiq Mosque at a time when infantry soldiers deployed on a large scale and opened live ammunition at Palestinian civilians and even at media personnel. The Israeli soldiers obstructed residents from entering the refugee camp to retrieve their belongings before the demolition of their houses. Local estimates indicate that Israeli army bulldozers tore down 20 structures in the previous week, and the occupation troops blew up other residential structures whose owners were displaced. 2 weeks ago, on May 1st, Israeli occupying forces issued military orders to demolish 106 Palestinian-owned structures in Tul Karem and Nur Shams refugee camps, giving residents 24 hours to evacuate. In Jenin, also in the northern West Bank, Israeli forces have expanded its incursion into the Jenin refugee camp, going on 115 days. The Jenin municipality said that Israeli forces have completely demolished approximately 600 homes inside the camp, while the rest have been partially damaged and rendered uninhabitable. The occupation continues to fire live ammunition intensively in the camp, Wafa News Agency reported. 2 weeks ago, as we reported, the Jenin-based veteran journalist Ali Samoudi was arrested after Israeli soldiers raided his home, beat him, and took him to a military barracks. The 58-year-old reporter has now been sentenced by an Israeli military court to 6 months administrative detention, which is an arbitrary imprisonment without charge or trial, and he is currently in Megiddo prison. Administrative detention orders can, of course, be renewed indefinitely. Samoudi was working alongside Al Jazeera correspondent Shireen Abu Akleh when she was assassinated by an Israeli sniper in May 2022. He was also shot in the shoulder during that attack. CNN, which has worked with Samoudi over the years, stated that the Israeli military acknowledged that it does not have sufficient evidence to substantiate terrorism funding allegations it leveled against Samoudi, but the military court sentenced him anyway. The military's administrative detention order cites Samoudi's, quote, presence posing a danger to the security of the region as justification for his detention. He's one of 20 journalists detained and held under administrative detention since the start of the war on Gaza, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Society. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine. Our longtime contributor, Mohammed Assad, an incredible photojournalist, recently posted these images to his Instagram account. He says that after 2 months of Israel's forced starvation policy, he had no choice but to dive into the sea, trying to catch any fish to get a little protein for his children. He writes that even though he was forced to swim amongst raw sewage and evade Israeli naval ships that opened fire at fishers on the shore, as well as a quadcopter drone that bombed a fisher next to him, he returned with an octopus for his family. Mohammed says, quote, I don't know if I should feel joy for bringing back this food or simply for surviving. Mahmoud Zweiter, a prominent actor and comedian in Gaza, posted this last week. I'll narrate what he says after we play this short clip. That was Mahmoud Zweiter. While walking and holding three blooming roses, he says, quote, these were planted in Gaza, folks. Can you imagine? The owner of a shop stopped me and gave them to me. I told him that I was embarrassed to walk down the street with them, but he insisted that I take them because my birthday is coming up. They grew in Gaza. Do you see? God is good and generous. This rose is for you, from the inside of Gaza to you. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. And you're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague Ali Abunima. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Nora. Thank you for that extraordinary report. That just, it's so much to take in. Thank you. And yeah. Now let's go straight to Gaza. Just a reminder that you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Ali Abunema here with my colleague Nora Barrows-Friedman. Today, May 15th, is Nakba Day, the annual commemoration of the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine by the Zionist colonial movement backed by Imperial Britain. But the Nakba has never ended, only accelerated with Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza. 1 week ago, Asim al-Nabi wrote these words in an Instagram post. I don't know how I can keep my calm amid all this madness or how I have the courage to reassure my family and people, to comfort them and calm them down in the midst of all this death and destruction. I didn't take part in writing the fates of people. I'm not a king or a president or a person in power to do something that could stop the death. I'm just a simple young man who suddenly found himself in a waterfall of blood, unable with his frail body to stop all this bleeding. Amid all this uncertainty, I know one thing to be true, that this occupation is following step by step the path of tyrants who came before it, and the end of that path is its downfall. So it's enough for us to know that this life is short and trivial, and that death is the fate of every living being. So pass whatever judgment you will, you're only passing judgment over this worldly life. Joining us now from Gaza is Asamin Nabir, who serves as the spokesperson for the Gaza City Municipality and is intimately familiar with the realities in Gaza. He's an engineer and a PhD researcher. He's also a regular contributor to the Electronic Intifada. Asim, welcome back to the Electronic Intifada live stream.
I'm very glad. Thank you. Very glad to be with you again.
Thank you, Asim. We're so grateful for your time amid so much desperate need and such a difficult situation. Asim, starvation and what the World Food Program is calling the risk of famine across the entire Gaza Strip is the current reality. Please just give us a sense of how you and the people around you are trying to cope with this reality.
To be honest, there is a lot of crisis now around the city. If we talk like a full view to the city, you can see there's destruction in the infrastructure. There is a water scarcity. There is, I can say, like collapsing of the medical system. All the civic facilities and the municipal services almost zero now. And on the top of that, there is a starvation. I personally lost 6 kg in the last 2 months, adding to another 10 that I already lost it from the war. I also did with my colleagues a paper, an article, and we published it. We have published in a high impact factor journal talking about the starvation in Gaza. One of the most important numbers that we found in this paper, that the majority of people, 98% of the total participants in our paper, lost more than 18 kg, an average of 18 kg. And based on our study, this is roughly 22% of the total pre-war weight. This is not just a speech or an observation. It's a scientific paper following the systematic scientific procedures. So I can tell you this is starvation, you know, this is engineered starvation. I consider myself lucky because I have a daily meal, usually like rice and salad. I wrote about that. But what about the injured? What about the elderly people? What about the nurse? There's a lot of people who literally they don't have daily meal. And of course, the prices now are like, you know, pricey. And there is limited options on the markets. You can't get even the simplest items like flour and sugar, which is very important now. If you want to do a bread or something, this is the most important thing. And as a person in Gaza, you know, when I looked to the world, I waited for 18 months for any real action. But unfortunately, after 586 days, there's only statements from the international community. There's only words. But maybe I can wait for another 2 weeks or for another 2 months. But what about the children? I see my nephews, the children in Gaza here, they are really starving. They don't have enough food. they don't have enough basic, you know, basics. We are talking about basics. So I think the media talked about that, talked about the famine and the starvation in Gaza. But what should we talk about is what should we do, what the world should do about this? Because everyone knows there's a starvation in Gaza right now. And time is running out. Yes, there's some news talking about 14 lost their lives in the past 2 weeks, but there's another people who already lost their lives in the last starvation last year. So we can't just wait. I'm calling everybody around the world to do something. You all know that there is a starvation in Gaza. I can't really explain, because starvation is a starvation. Everyone should know and should understand what does that mean. So it's another call to do something. People here, they can't wait. And this is, again, is the international laws. That's it, Ali.
Awesome. When we keep hearing the news and it lift, I mean, after 18 months, we don't dare to hope anymore. And the last time we spoke to you, which was in February, we felt a little bit of hope, because we talked to you during that ceasefire, which lasted from January 19th until March 18th. And you at that time were talking about the efforts of the municipality to clear the roads, to restore services. Although things were not easy at that time, we felt, and I feel like you felt, a little bit of hope at that time. And each day we hear there's going to be something, a ceasefire, or the food will come in, and the trucks are all lined up at the border in Egypt. And then another day passes, and all we get is another massacre and more starvation. And we see the headlines, even from some of the international communities, they talk about Gaza is on the brink of famine, or Gaza is threatened with famine. They use this kind of language when you're telling us that people are losing on average 18 kilograms, 40 pounds of their body weight. I mean, what I want to ask you is, right now, what are people surviving on? I mean, no food is coming in. Are they just surviving on what was stored already in Gaza? Are they able to grow some? What are people surviving on? How are they making it from day to day? And last week we had one of our guests, Dunya Abu Sitta from Gaza, who talked about how some families go without eating for 2 or 3 days. How long can this continue before we start seeing mass death from hunger? I'm sorry to ask such a blunt question.
Now people are trying to do, for example, instead of eating 3 meals a day, they are eating 1 meal a day, and they reduce the amount of that meal. So if they usually eat like a full meal, they now they eat like half of that meal. And they start to get, how can I say it? It's like a quota food for every child and for every person on a family. He got only a small amount of food. And, you know, in our tradition, Palestinian, they don't separate food, they don't divide food based on the, you know, for amounts. We just eat, we used to have like sufficient amount of food, so, but we have no options now. And this is for the lucky people in Gaza. But when we talk about hundreds of thousands in the makeshift displacement areas, in the schools, in the streets, in the tents, they used to rely on, you know, that we call it tikiya, which is like someone bring some food to that school or to that displacement area and distribute food for the people. So I can tell you there is a lot of people, many people rely on this food. And because there is no aid right now entering Gaza, and there is no enough money to buy food, a lot of people lost even this this meal. I see children in the on the streets. I see families trying to find some food from the environment, like, you know, some grass, maybe some. They cut the wood now to fire and to make to cook that I can't say food, to cook their meals, if we can say that. So it is very difficult to get one meal daily, and if you are lucky to have one meal, it's not a healthy meal, you know, maybe canned food or maybe just some rice with only maybe like water, a cup of water or something like that. So it is very difficult to explain what starvation means, because if I'm lucky enough to have a meal today, I'm not sure if I will have it tomorrow. And this is the truth now. Again, I consider myself lucky because I have that privilege to have a daily meal. But what about the people in the city? What about the people in Gaza Strip? We are talking about 2 million people, more than 2 million people who are really starving. And the world knows about that. Everyone around the world that knows that there is a starvation in Gaza now. So again, I want to back to that point that everyone knows what's next.
Yeah, and why aren't they stopping it? Asim, in the post you wrote on Instagram, you said that you feel that this tyranny will come to an end, that we will all see its downfall. How are you and people in Gaza able to hold on to any shred of hope at this point? What does it mean to even have hope at this point?
I mean, just during your question, I remember President Kennedy once said, those who foolishly sought power by riding the back of the tiger ended up inside. He said that, I think, in 1961 in his speech. And USA did that mistake in Vietnam, you know? And 60 years later, Israel did the same mistake, using an intensive power against civilian people won't solve any issue. And I believe in the history. I believe that things are going to change, because you can't kill everyone. You can't raise us. A lot of people tried that. And a wise man said, those who foolishly sought power by riding the back of the tiger ended up inside. So it is very clear that one day, sooner or later, we will get our freedom. We will get our self-determination. And it is not a difficult and it's not a complicated issue. Palestinian cause is not a complicated issue. It's very simple. There is people here. They lived here for 1,000 years. They ask for their rights. You can't ignore them forever. There is only one solution, to give them their rights. And yes, they ignored our voice. They blamed us for our screaming, you know, but I mean, we won't be silent. We will try our best. We will do everything to get our freedom. And I believe everyone in Gaza Strip, every Palestinian in Palestine and outside Palestine, believe the same, that using that power against us won't raise us. So I keep repeating that to my friends, to my family, that they can kill 100,000 people, but they can't kill everyone. So I live for that hope, that I might, I hope not, but I might be one of those victims. My family, I lost a lot of my friends, even my nephews, my brother-in-law, but I have to keep that hope inside me to live, to fight. Otherwise, we would leave this land. But I believe things are going to be changed. Sooner or later, we will get our freedom, and the world has to take some actions, because everyone is calling for peace. So, and Palestinians, of course. So there is some actions have to be taken from the people in power. And I hope after all of these sacrifices in Gaza and in Palestine, West Bank, Jerusalem, everywhere, we will reach to that point, and you will know, everyone will see that this hope is not in vain. I hope this will be soon. We can't, and we don't want to wait for too much time. But I promise, this is coming.
Awesome. Coming from you, coming from the heart of Gaza, those words carry such depth and weight. And especially on Nakba Day, when we know, I mean, this is the 77th commemoration of the Nakba, which never stopped and never ended, is ongoing. But the Zionists thought that we would be erased and forgotten many decades ago. And we are still here. You're still here. The people in Gaza are still there. And I share your faith, and I know many watching share your faith, that we will see Palestine liberated, and all this horror and suffering will not have been for nothing. That I'm sure of that. Awesome. Before we let you go, and we don't want to take too much of your precious time, I just want to ask you what message you have. What's the most important thing for people outside Gaza to know? And what do you think? I ask you this every time, but I think it's important to ask you this every time. What should they be doing? What do you want people who are watching, and we hope many will watch, around the world to do?
Also, I have a different answer this time, Ali, because I believe everyone knows what is happening in Gaza. I don't need to tell you what is happening. Simply, we have been killed for 18 months by Israel. Not by 18 months, for 77 years. And I don't need to explain more. This is what is happening. And also, I'm sorry for that, I shouldn't tell you what to do. I live under a genocide for 18 months. There's a lot to do. And you should think, you should do something. You should take that effort, because I'm living in Gaza, you know. And when some of my friends outside Gaza asked me this question, I said, come on, you should do something. You should think and do something. You should try to do something. Because as someone said, prayers that don't resist oppression are just like an empty drumbeat. Actions is very important. Words is okay. It is very important, but actions is essential. And please don't wait for someone in Gaza to tell the world what they should do. Yes, you should all keep talking about Gaza. You should all tell your friends and families about Gaza. You should all donate the projects in Gaza. You should all do something. But please try to invent things to stop the genocide here. There is more than 2 million people under this miserable conditions for more than 587 days. They can't think, they can't tell anybody what to do because we care about our daily meals. My father is 60, he turned 60 years in April. And now he's supposed to be in his comfort zone now, enjoying his retirement, but he's carrying water. He has only one meal in a day. So I can't ask him what the people of the site Gaza should do. So you should do something because this blood is not only Palestinian blood. It's anyone in the world. Any free guy, any free man outside Gaza should feel that this is his blood also. So again, Ali, this is a different question. I don't want to tell you what to do. You should do something to stop the genocide.
We hear you loud and clear, Asim. We need to hear it every day, not to stop talking about Gaza, not to stop acting in every way we can, and people are. We can do more, we must do more. And you remind us that this is our responsibility because many of us are sitting in countries whose governments are supporting this genocide, if not just with words, giving justifications, excuses, but funding it, trading normally with Israel, even arming Israel. And that's our responsibility as citizens. And it's not the responsibility of people in Gaza, but we need to hear that reminder, and you delivered it with such eloquence. Awesome. And we're so grateful to you. We're praying for you and everyone in Gaza, and we pledge to continue talking about Gaza, never to be silent, never to stop, no matter what. Thank you, Asim. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you soon. Awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Very heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to come face to face with this reality and feel like we could just reach through the screen and touch Asim and touch the people there, and we can't do that. But the culprits of this genocide are close to many of us. They're the companies, the corporations, and we're going to talk about one of those corporations next, our governments. And I just want to encourage people, you know, by the way, the American Friends Service Committee, for those who aren't aware of it, the American Friends Service Committee has an action hour every Friday that you can join online, and right there online, everyone does an action together, whether it's calling a member of Congress, and they give you a message and a script. And that's the minimum we can all do. Yeah. And everyone can do something. Not everyone can do the same thing. Yeah. Some people have more ability, but everyone can do something, even if it's just to raise your voice. And we can't stop doing that.
Yeah. And, you know, plug in where you can to the best of your ability. And there's always something to do. I think, you know, kind of saying that, well, I'm just one individual. What difference is it going to make if I do, you know, X, Y, or Z? I think that that's been something that's been drilled into us, I think, in this society, that one person can't possibly make a difference, that you might as well just give up and stop speaking out and stop trying to organize because it won't be.
Well, they wouldn't be trying to stop us. They wouldn't be repressing people in the UK and in Germany and in the US. They wouldn't be arresting people and deporting people and dragging them in for interrogations and intimidating them if none of this mattered.
Yeah.
It does matter. It still matters. They want to make us feel.
Yeah.
They want to make us feel that our voices don't matter. But if our voices didn't matter, they wouldn't be trying to shut us up.
That's exactly it. Well, in that vein, we are now going to speak to some people who are making a huge difference. Just to remind you, you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman, here with my colleague Ali Abunima. It's almost impossible for any of us to avoid contact with products made by Microsoft. It's not just familiar applications like Word, Excel, and PowerPoint, or the ubiquitous Windows operating system. You may not realize it, but when you withdraw money from an ATM, it's very likely that that machine is running a Microsoft application. When you book a ticket or interact with customer service on an airline, it's likely that this is processed on systems developed by the US-based software company. And your medical records might also be stored on systems created by Microsoft. And those are just a few ways that the US-based software firm is woven into everyday life. Microsoft's massive reach helped drive sales of $70 billion just in the first quarter of this year, and boosted profits by 18%. Much of this windfall is driven by the company's aggressive foray into AI, artificial intelligence. The company claims on its website that its mission is, quote, to help every person and organization develop and use AI in a way that serves the public good. Microsoft also claims that its goal is to protect people's fundamental rights and mitigate potential harm, to promote responsible business practices, to protect democracy, and advance fair and inclusive societies. However, last month, Microsoft held a celebration for its employees, marking 50 years since the US-based software giant was founded. With so much success, what is not to celebrate? It didn't go exactly as planned. Let's take a look at this video from that event.
Good, but Microsoft sells AI weapons.
Thank you for your protest, I hear you. I hear your protest, thank you.
Shame on you! You are a war profiteer.
I hear you, thank you.
Stop using AI for genocide in our region. You have blood on your hands. All of Microsoft has blood on its hands. How dare you all celebrate when Microsoft is killing children? Shame on you all. Shame on you.
That was Microsoft employee Ibtihal Abusad protesting the company's sale of its AI and Azure cloud computing technologies to the Israeli military, enabling the ongoing genocide. Abusad was not the only employee to protest at the event. Vanya Agrawal also challenged the company's complicity in Israel's crimes. And let's watch that.
Shame on you all. You're all hypocrites. I'm a Microsoft worker. And I do not consent.
Thank you.
50,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been murdered with Microsoft technology.
Thank you.
How dare you? Shame on all of you for celebrating on their blood. Cut ties with Israel. No Azure for apartheid. Microsoft AI kills kids. Microsoft powers genocide.
And not surprisingly, both Abu Assad and Agrawal were fired after their protests made headlines and went viral on social media. nor were they the first to be fired for such actions. In October, Abdul Mohammed, a researcher and data scientist, and Hossam Nasser, a software engineer, were fired after organizing a vigil outside Microsoft headquarters in Redmond, Washington, to protest the company's role in Israel's mass killing of Palestinians. Microsoft workers call their ongoing campaign against the company's complicity No Azure for Apartheid. And we're pleased to be joined now by former Microsoft employee Vanya Agrawal and by a current employee, June. That's not her real name. For obvious reasons, we're hiding her real name. June and Vanya, thank you so much. It's an honor to welcome you to the Electronic Intifada live stream today.
Thank you so much for having us. It's really a privilege to be here with both you, Nora, and Ali.
Well, thank you. Vanya, in that powerful video of you protesting at the company celebration, you say 50,000 Palestinians have been murdered along with Microsoft technology. Can you explain in everyday terms how exactly the Israeli military is using Microsoft software? What role do Microsoft's products play in the mass slaughter we are seeing in Gaza every day?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Microsoft is key in aiding and abetting in Israel's genocide of the Palestinian people. Throughout this whole year, actually, Microsoft has been celebrating its 50th year anniversary, always making a point to highlight their philanthropist impact, but every month we continue to learn more and more about how Microsoft and its services have enabled and accelerated the genocide in Gaza. There have been multiple investigations by news outlets, including The Guardian, AP News, DropSite News, and others. Microsoft knowingly provides Israel with technology, including artificial intelligence, that's deployed to facilitate grave human rights violations, war crimes, crimes against humanity, including apartheid, as well as genocide. This relationship between Microsoft and the IOF dates back decades. In 2002, Microsoft participated in the largest software deal in Israel at the time. And since then, Microsoft's partnerships with the Israeli apartheid regime have only expanded. In 2021, for instance, Microsoft signed a three-year contract with the Israeli Ministry of Defense worth $133 million. And now in 2025, Microsoft has essentially a footprint in all major military infrastructures in Israel, with military service agreements that span across more than 600 individual subscriptions tied to different divisions, units, bases, and projects within the Israeli military. And these agreements mean that Microsoft provides the Israeli military with Azure Cloud, AI, and storage services, which the Israeli military uses to construct their automated weapons platform and essentially mass assassination factory, which automate and accelerate the crimes through systems like The Gospel, Lavender, and Where's Daddy? And these systems are responsible for developing kill lists and target banks, and they aid in the surveillance of an indiscriminate bombing of the Palestinian people. And what's notable is that we've seen the Israeli military's reliance on Microsoft's Azure Cloud technology and AI services has actually surged since its genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza. And according to usage data from March of just last year, the military's usage of Microsoft and OpenAI artificial intelligence actually spiked nearly 200 times higher than pre-October 2023. Even besides cloud and AI, Microsoft provides software, cloud support, consulting services to the Israeli military and government. They embed workers in the military units, and they provide staff and contractors to give specialized consulting and tech support to Israel. So Microsoft really forms the technological backbone of Israel's automated apartheid and genocide systems, and is ultimately a digital weapons manufacturer at the end of the day. What we're witnessing is the first AI-powered genocide that literally runs on Microsoft Azure. And it's not just Microsoft, to be fair. It's Amazon, Google, and all these tech companies. They're all complicit. In this digital and AI age, cloud and AI have really become as deadly as bombs and bullets.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Vanya. We'll come back to more of that, but I want to turn to June right now. June, you're currently a worker at Microsoft, which is why, quite understandably, we're not showing your face or using your real name. But talk about the impact of these protests within the company from your perspective. How widely are the concerns that you're raising in this campaign, how widely are they shared? And what impact are you seeing from the actions that some of your colleagues and now fired colleagues have taken?
Thank you for asking. I think as far as the impact within the company, the campaign has been around for around a year, but after Vanya and Ibtihal's protests, we saw a surge in global interest and support for what the campaign is calling for, which is, of course, divestment and Israel off Azure. So as an individual, when I speak to the people around me and speak to fellow employees, I sense a general change that most people are against what's happening. And that's also reflected in the fact that people are flocking to the campaign from Microsoft offices all over the world. We're also seeing this in how, for example, as folks may know here already, Microsoft has become a priority target for the BDS campaign. And worldwide people are answering that call, even to the point of game developers who have written games for Xbox deciding to pull them from the store in order to heed the call to boycott Microsoft. So the data also within the company shows that they have these dashboards where they track sentiment around the company, and these dashboards show that the entire world is starting to understand that Microsoft's reputation for carrying out human rights is a false image, and understanding their complicity in the genocide that we're seeing. So it's I believe that we are at a turning point where this mass awareness and mass conviction that what is happening and what the company is participating in is wrong will enable us to make some change there.
Well, we also are joined by another current employee. We mentioned Hossam Nasser. Hossam, thank you so much for joining us. And if you could just tell us a little bit about why you also took the stand that you did and put your job on the line, and why it was important for you to do that act of protest.
Thank you so much for having me, and it's such an honor and a privilege to be here. To clarify, I no longer work for Microsoft. I was fired last October for organizing a visual with another organizer, Abdo, from the campaign. We organized a visual to honor the lives of the countless Palestinians who have been killed in Gaza with Microsoft technology. And I think for me, I always knew it. My activism and my organizing in general could very much lead to me losing my job, and I was always prepared for that as a consequence. And to answer your question, the reason is simply because we cannot afford to be silent in the face of the Holocaust of our time. It is simply unacceptable to have our labor be used to accelerate this genocide, to honestly have our tax dollars fund the bombs that are raining down on our brothers and sisters in Palestine and say nothing. Like, silence is complicity. And I could not bear the thought of having a drop of Palestinian blood on my hands. So it felt like, as somebody who has that privilege of, you know, I work for Microsoft, I have that sort of platform. That's the barest of minimums one can do, honestly. It's not like we should be asking ourselves, why are we not doing more?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Hossam. It's extraordinary that you and Vanya and Ibtihal, and I know that you have another colleague, who were fired for the stand you took. And after Vania and Tihal were fired, the No Azure for Apartheid campaign put out a statement that said, in part, while Microsoft tried to celebrate 50 years of war profiteering as a tech weapons company, we made it clear we will not write code that kills and we will not celebrate while Microsoft has blood on its hands. It also states, quote, with full conviction, we can say that losing our jobs is a trivial price to pay for our principles, and we fight for a free Palestine from the river to the sea. I really have two questions, and this is for any of you, so you can take turns if you want to. But I mean, on the one hand, Microsoft is an enormous company. It's one of the world's richest companies. As we said, it's embedded in almost every aspect of daily life. You don't know that the ATMs or the parking lot payment machines are running Microsoft until they go on the blink and you see that Windows logo that tells you that they're running Microsoft. But I mean, why can't they just ignore you? They're a big, powerful company. Why should they care that a few employees decided to, you know, throw themselves under the bus? I'm playing devil's advocate here, but I want you to really kind of push on that. And then I have another question. I want to ask you what you would say, as Vania pointed out, Microsoft is a big player here. But it's not the only one. There are other enormous tech companies that are complicit in this genocide, and smaller ones too. What would you say to tech workers in other companies, not just Microsoft?
Vania, do you want to kick it off?
Yeah, sure. I think they're really good questions. Maybe I can kind of take the second one of what we want to say to other Microsoft workers, and I'll let either Tune or Hassan take the other one.
And work not just in Microsoft and other tech workers generally in the industry.
Yes, definitely. I think just to echo what Hassan has said, you know, everybody that is able should be using their position, power, and privilege to speak up and hold those in power accountable. And like I mentioned, it's not just Microsoft, it's Amazon, it's Google, it's Palantir, it's all these big tech companies that we've been worshiping and idolizing for years, saying that they are at the forefront of innovation and helping make our future better. We need to reframe this idea that all tech is tech for good and for the evolution and continuation of innovation and humanity. It's so clear now that all of these tech companies are really just weapons manufacturers under the hood. And you know, as the targeted and weaponized famine continues to surge and escalate in Gaza, the time has passed for silence and inaction. Silence is complicity, inaction is complicity, and just sharing posts on social media, that's not enough. Commenting on a picture of another martyred journalist or another starving child is not enough. And when it comes to Microsoft and Google and Amazon and across the tech sector, we need to hold all of these companies accountable to their missions and their values. We need to demand that they cut ties that they end these bloody contracts. And we need to make it more expensive for them to continue these ties than to cut them, which means boycotting them, boycotting their products, not giving them a single dollar as they continue to profit from genocide of Palestinians, not give them a single ounce of our labor and our time and our energy. I demand that your workplaces divest from Israel, even outside the tech sector. Like, refuse to have your labor power apartheid and genocide. And do this through building community, organizing, and protesting. I'm part of the No Azure for Apartheid campaign, and we have so many amazing people that span across the whole spectrum of risk tolerance and risk levels, and people who are playing roles at each part of that spectrum, from taking actions like what Ibtihal and I did that are loud and disruptive and public, to more actions behind the scenes that the campaigns and grassroots movements really desperately need. There's a role truly for everybody to play in this movement. And we really have so much power in our numbers, and we have to do everything in our power to end this. And any sacrifice, like Hossam said, any sacrifice we can make is well worth the cause to see a free and liberated Palestine within our lifetime. And like Asim said, you know, protecting Palestine is really protecting the world. So huge call to all workers, tech workers, Microsoft workers, Amazon workers, even workers outside the tech sector, like, demand that all of these companies divest from Israel and don't give them your labor or your time.
Thank you for that. Hossam or June, do you want to also jump in?
Sure. I'd love to add on to that. As Fania said, I think the amazing thing is the power of the collective coming together to try to exert pressure on the company, because, like, as much as Vanya and Hossam and these individuals made an amazing disruptive protest that also came out of a sustained campaign of organizing and preparing for those moments. And I think that the evidence of why that is really powerful is also in the extent to which Microsoft has attempted to repress any type of organizing around this. So they have essentially rearranged a lot of their business operations entirely around trying to prevent the campaign from gaining more momentum. And I'll just give a couple of examples, but they have basically dismantled their internal social media platforms because discussions of Microsoft's complicity were getting too uncomfortable for them, and they didn't want the word to spread, so they've locked those down. Next week, they're having one of their largest events for customers. It's called Microsoft Build, and one of their primary objectives for the event is to avoid a rally that the campaign is organizing at the event to hold both Microsoft and the people who are attending and potentially giving them money accountable. And it's really amazing because while it started as a small group of people, it is growing exponentially in size. And it's really evident in their response to us that they're very frightened of the impact that we're going to have on the company. Hossam, do you want to speak to this more?
Yeah, I mean, I think, to answer your question of why can't they just ignore you? I mean, they have tried their very best to ignore us, and they have ignored us. And this is why it was our responsibility to make Palestine unavoidable and to make it so that they cannot ignore us, because our voices are louder than theirs, and they cannot just brush us away like they want us to do. This is why their statement is always like, well, you know, there is proper channels or whatever to provide this feedback, because they do ignore these so-called proper channels, and that's what they want people to focus on. So our responsibility, and I think we've hopefully done a good job of that, is to make it so that they are forced to not ignore us, and that at the end of the day, I think our responsibility is to exact the highest possible cost on Microsoft and those tech companies and affect their bottom line. They are ultimately profit-seeking companies. They have zero material weight to Palestinian lives, or to any lives for that matter. It's a numbers game for them. So if we make it cost more than those contracts are worth, that's ultimately how we get them to divest. And lastly, to your second question on, you know, what to say to tech workers and in other companies or at Microsoft, we are at the point where the tech industry in general, big tech, is the military industrial complex of this century. These giant tech companies are the Raytheons and the Lockheed Martins and the Boeings of our world that are just as essential to the destruction in Gaza as those physical sort of munition companies. So make your decision accordingly. And in my opinion, if you work for at least some of these like really big tech companies, you are complicit, and you will, you know, history will remember you as such if you do, if you're not at the very least organizing, if you're not speaking up about Palestine, if you're not doing something about it. It is not on, I want to push on this narrative that some people have that, you know, Vania and myself and whatever, we were like so brave to do this. Like, no, we were not. This is, that's not how history is going to remember us. History will remember us as like having done the absolute bare minimum in the face of the Holocaust, and everyone else is coward. It's not that, that we are brave.
So. Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And as we wrap up, I mean, how can people, the general public, people in activist communities, support people like June, current Microsoft workers who are putting their livelihoods and possibly their careers on the line to do the bare minimum to protest this genocide? What actions are you calling on the general public to take?
And I don't mean to interrupt you, Nora, but I also want to push back a little bit, because in this society, the bare minimum has become a lot.
Yes.
Because people have been so depoliticized and so bullied and intimidated into silence that that actually, I want to say it does take, I want to tell you that you, what you did is courageous and it is extraordinary, but we don't want it to be rare. We want more people to be courageous and extraordinary the way you were. So I understand what you're saying, but I also want to thank you and acknowledge that you have done something that so many other people haven't done. And that does take courage. I'm sorry, Nora.
No, no. It's a really good point. I mean, like, what? How can people support you and learn more about the campaign and encourage their, you know, coworkers and colleagues to take similar stances wherever they're employed?
I'm happy to start with that. I think, Ali, to your point, like, I recognize my privilege and position being a US citizen, being able to take a stand like this that's so loud and public, and not really putting much beyond my own life on the line. Like, not everybody can do this without putting so much on the line with their families, their homes, people that they support. It is scary times, but sort of like I mentioned, there are ways to be involved and take action without putting yourself in the line of fire if you're not able to take that risk. Our protest was a very coordinated and planned effort. That protest that you saw on April 4th wouldn't have happened without all of the folks working behind the scenes that made it happen. And as I mentioned, grassroots movements especially have such a variety of needs and roles that assume different levels of risks. So I would really say the way to support is to organize and build your community and figure out what you are able to do and do it and take action however you can. And it's really important to remember that we do outnumber them and we have so much power in our collective. Even just within Microsoft, the workers far outnumber the CEOs, and there's so much power in that. So for our campaign specifically, I would really urge everyone, get involved however you can, answer the BDS call, boycott Microsoft, pressure Microsoft. We have petitions for the No Azure Apartheid campaign that folks can sign to hold Microsoft accountable and pressure them into answering our demands to disclose, divest, call for a ceasefire, and protect their employees who speak out. And for those who are willing to assume a little more risk, make those demands of these workplaces, refuse to have your labor power, apartheid and genocide. And just remember that no action is small. In this movement, the smallest things, from making a sandwich for mutual aid or making a sign, that is a form of resistance. And yeah, if Hassam or June want to add anything else, I'll pass it over to them.
Thank you, Vania. Absolutely agree with all of those things. If you are able to sign our petitions, that's really helpful. If you're able to support the campaign by following us on social media, we'd love that. If you can push people who either buy Microsoft products or maybe work at Microsoft, that is always helpful. If you happen to be in the Seattle area and can join us at our rally to physically confront Microsoft, we would love to have you. And you can find details about that on our social media. And one more thing is that I think a more general call that we've been talking about, not to just workers at Microsoft, but to workers at other companies and just people everywhere, is that if you can organize to take collective action, now is the time. And I want to emphasize that I know I'm in a position of privilege as well, where I'm hiding my face and name now, not because I'm afraid to get fired, but because I'm saving it for the right moment. And I think that, as we've said so many times, there's power in taking action together. And it's not just about doing the right things or going through what they tell us are the proper channels, that are the channels that enable them to ignore what we're doing. It's the best thing that we can do for the movement is to figure out ways to escalate beyond what they want us to do.
Thank you. I love that. Waiting for the right moment. Absolutely. Hassam, did you want to close us out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that generally, I think this is like the points that Vania and June have brought up have been really important. I think that ultimately the message I want to send is the genocide in Gaza has reached extremely urgent levels. Like when we launched this campaign a year ago, it felt extremely urgent, and it felt like it's something that we must, you know, put everything on the line for. And now a year later, it feels even more urgent, and that was inconceivable a year ago. The deliberate starvation campaign is ongoing and accelerating. Dozens have already died of starvation that we're aware of. Israel has announced officially plans to completely take over Gaza and exterminate the remaining population and leave the lead the rest out of Gaza. I guess my message would be like if a lot of people think that we need to play the long game and sort of like, you know, be strategic and be sort of cunning and wise and it's not, you know, we shouldn't be very loud right now. We should like wait until we have more power and more privilege and more voice. And this is when we can really make an impactful difference. And I want to really challenge that. Like if anybody is holding on to any privilege, I realize my privilege was my job, because thankfully I don't have kids I have to support. I was not, you know, supporting my family financially. I was in a financial position that allowed me to be without a job for a few months. And that is a privilege that I recognize so many people don't have. But if anybody in general is holding on to any privilege, whether that is citizenship right now is a huge privilege, a job or even a voice or anything like that. And they are thinking, you know, I just need to hold on to this for the long game, for like the big picture. I'm going to ask, like, if not now, then when? If it's not going to be this genocide, if it's not going to be when Palestinians are being starved and babies are being decapitated, and Israel has become the number one leading cause of death for children worldwide, if it's not going to be that, then what is it going to be?
Really well said. Thank you so much, Hassam Nasser and Vania Agrawal. former Microsoft workers, and of course June, a current Microsoft worker. And again, the social media.
At least two ways. You probably have more social media accounts. We encourage everyone to follow and find out what actions you're taking, as well as how they can participate if they want to. So there is your, I think that's your account on Twitter, X, no AZ for apartheid, no AZ number four apartheid. And you also have the same handle on Instagram. And if people just search for no Azure for apartheid, using different search engines, maybe, then they will find you.
Amazing. Thank you all so much for doing this work and building this campaign and speaking out and encouraging everyone else to do so. And we hope to have you back on the program when the campaign has completed its mission. So thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada live stream.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us. It's an honor.
Thank you.
Extraordinary. And I think that question is so timely and timeless and profound. If not now, when?
Yeah.
If not
exactly.
now, when?
Yeah. What are we waiting
for? What more needs to happen?
Yeah. Yeah. That's it.
And they are courageous and they're extraordinary and they're leaders. And I hope many others will take them as examples of moral and really incredible
ethical.
Solidarity.
Ethical.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Ali. Just a reminder, you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. Let's bring John on for the Resistance Report. Hey, John.
Hello, guys. Another great show.
Thanks.
Thanks, John.
It was great to hear from Asim.
I mean,
he's doing heroic work. I don't know if that word gets used too much, but it's in the truest sense what he's doing. Mm-hmm. So it's an honor to have him on our show.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And, you know, it's the acceleration of attacks across Gaza has been just unbearable to watch unfold hour by hour, especially over the last week or so. But the resistance isn't letting up. And but why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch of what you're going to take us on today?
Well, I mean, the attacks are on civilians, right? That's the way that it's been this whole time. But the resistance is fighting in Rafah, where the civilians have all been ethnically cleansed from. And carried out a series of pretty impressive tactical achievements against the Israeli military and released those on video, as they have all throughout the war, giving us this remarkable front row view to the national liberation struggle. So I will be reporting on that.
Okay, well, take it away.
All right. So you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada. I am John Elmer. This is the Resistance Report for day 587 of the genocide. It is also day 75 of the total siege on the Gaza Strip. No food, no medicine. If you didn't catch Nora's news report off the top of the show, I highly recommend that as excellent coverage of an absolutely disgusting and devastating situation that the people of Gaza are living through right now. A couple big stories this week were the release, Qassam Brigades released an American soldier, an Israeli soldier who is an American, who is a lone soldier, who was captured from his base in his tank with other soldiers on the Gaza border in the northeast edge of the Gaza envelope. And Qassam released him this week in a good faith gesture to attempt to get the Americans to engage in negotiations to open the crossings. They understood that those crossings would be opened based on the release of that soldier. It was unprecedented and historic release for no no prisoner exchange. And I think that we are seeing right now that that good faith gesture has been essentially ignored by the Americans. They're duplicitous and criminal in this, and they're responsible for it in many critical ways. An article in Haaretz this week talked about how U.S. funding has covered 70% of Israel's war-related spending. And as we know, I reported a number of times late last year that the first year of the war alone, the United States gave roughly $23 billion to the Israelis. And in Haaretz this week, a foreign ministry official said, if the U.S. chose to brandish the whip and tie aid to political demands, it would be very hard for us to resist. That's the problem with our dependency. At the moment of truth, the American president can simply say, stop the war, period. And that's what Qassam was hoping for in their attempt to alleviate the suffering, mass starvation and famine in Gaza. And that soldier was a soldier from the Golani Brigade's 51st Battalion. And the Golani Brigade 51st Battalion is who are in these operations that I'm going to be showing you throughout this show. So it's worth noting that. So let's look at the maps. As always, we got these maps updated again. The noose is tightening around the civilian populations, as is the intention of the Israelis. We're now at 70% no-go buffer zone. Again, the purple is the buffer zone. The orange is the evacuation displacement orders, the ethnic cleansing orders, the erasure orders in this case, because we're particularly talking about southern Gaza. If we look at that map to zoom in on the south, we can see that Rafah has been completely... that the population has been pushed out of Rafah completely. And I have been talking recently about the Morag Corridor. That is the corridor that runs between Rafah and Khan Yunis. So I just wanted to show you with this next map. This map is from 2003. And just to show you that this is the situation as of October 24th, 2003. This is when I was reporting in Rafah on this siege. And you can see the way that the Morag Corridor is marked on this map. It is the red lines that marks through. It's called a security zone during the Israeli occupation when the settlers were inside Gaza. And you can see that corridor was devoid of people all along. The purple on the coast, that's Gush Katif. That was an Israeli settlement. And that area just off Khan Yunis is Mawasi. And that's where the civilian population in Gaza has been corralled. And so these military operations are following a historic understanding and order, and they're moving through areas that have already been long ago established as corridors. And you can see the Egypt buffer zone there on the map to the left. That is the Philadelphia corridor that has been expanded. And of course, we know about the Netzarim corridor that divides northern Gaza around Wadi Gaza. So these are already established routes. And I just wanted to bring this map in because I know I've been talking about that for a number of weeks now, about the Morag corridor, and saying it's not a military accomplishment to take the Morag corridor, because this corridor has existed in this way. This is how Israel controlled the territory from 1967 until 2005 when they left. So the focus of the fighting is, again, it's on the Golani Brigade 51st Battalion, and it's the Rafah Brigade still fighting. The Rafah Brigade that we were told in the summer had been defeated by Israel. We know that they lie about those declarations going back to November 2023 when they said they had operational control over Beit Hanun. Beit Hanun is still fighting. The Rafah Brigade has four battalions in the Rafah Brigade, and this show is going to focus on the Eastern Battalion. And you can still see the area that they're going to be fighting on this map, where you see Sahadin Street, Road, the main highway that runs north-south through Gaza, up into the Morag Corridor, because the use of the Morag Corridor is to allow Israeli troops to access the center of the territory, and then jump off from that, which is what they do from the Philadelphia Corridor. We know they do that in Tel HaSultan in western Rafah. That's where Yahya Sinwar was killed fighting in Tel HaSultan. And so in the Morag Corridor, it brings Israeli troops into the center of eastern Rafah. And that is what we are going to focus on today. These operations, Qassam named them the Gates of Hell. And we'll remember that that's also comes from Trump. Trump said that if the captives were not released, that they would bring the gates of hell down on Gaza. And the resistance has used these Israeli and American terms for the fight and has turned them on their head, like iron swords became the breaking the swords ambush. And this is the gates of hell operation. So what we're going to be seeing in this first one is these are complex ambushes, well executed, tactically executed. This is a tunnel-borne operation. All three of these operations are going to be based on tunnel operations, and they're targeting the Yahalom unit, which is Israel's anti-tunnel unit. They are auxiliary to the right now in Rafah, auxiliary to the Golani Brigade's 51st Battalion. And so we're going to be watching the Israelis advance from the Morag Corridor, and they're going to engage in a firefight with the Palestinian resistance is going to engage, the Qassam is going to engage them in a firefight and lure them into the building to target them from a detonated tunnel booby trap. So let's take a look at number four, the first one, Gates of Hell, part one. You can see on the screen, Gates of Hell. We have a commander here with a sign behind him that says Gates of Hell. And he says the leadership of Al-Qassam issued the following order to launch Gates of Hell series of operations. We assure you that Rafah, after a year of fighting this battle, that we are still dispelling your illusions and taking the lives of your soldiers. Let the Gates of Hell open wide. Let every home and every alley in Rafah become a ticking bomb that claims the lives of your best soldiers. That's what this commander is saying on screen here. And now we're going to see again, drone footage. We've seen this all throughout the war. And you can see the Morag Corridor line there. And that is the line of advance that the Israelis are going to take. The commander says, after studying the enemy's movements and behavior and advances in southern from the Morag Corridor, the location of the ambush has been selected and identified. The leadership has confirmed the selection of targets and the direction to eliminate them. In the next video, you're going to see a team of Qassam fighters lift off a mattress here and emerge from the tunnels. We're seeing this from a GoPro camera on their head. We're also going to see a camera in the room, but here's the fighters emerging. And this is the thing that we've seen all throughout this war. There's the backup camera that shows the fighters in the room, but they've given us this front row seat to the resistance. And these operations are really going to show you that. You can see this is the GoPro camera on the helmet or on the head of one of the fighters, and that shows you the fighter, the whole squad emerging from the room, which you can see on the next image as well. The next video, that's them emerging. And again, you can see the way that the backup camera, the car backup camera, has been used in these operations. Again, we've seen this all throughout the war, ingenuity here. And in the destroyed building, you can see the rubble around this building. The Israelis believe this building has been cleared. They have set up a position next to this building, and the fighters emerge from the tunnels and are able to execute these operations. So if we watch this next slide here, you're going to see the fighters move to the door and hit an Israeli patrol that's walking by. All through this video, you can hear the screams of the soldiers as they're getting fired upon. You can watch these uncensored videos on my Twitter account, which is just my name at Twitter. Maybe tomorrow I can throw that up on the ticker at some point. But they're screaming all through this, and then they slide back down into the tunnel. So you see the fighters sliding down in the tunnel. There's both the cameras, one on the head and one in the room. As the fighter disappears, this next slide shows you them firing out the door at the Israeli patrol. So they're luring the Israelis into this position, into this house. And you can see in the next slide them exiting down the tunnel, firing at the last for good measure. And this is the same. So you're seeing the helmet, you're seeing the GoPro camera on the head of the fighter, and then you're seeing the in-house camera, which is going to be key to this next one, because the Israelis will then send in a drone and their canine units that will arrive as a platoon. And I have pixel masked the Israeli soldiers because we have to follow community guidelines on YouTube, and we do that very faithfully, even though we don't think that they're justified, because we've, as everybody knows, we've been watching a live stream genocide where it's fine to kill Palestinians regularly on our phones and on our on various forms of media, but they're very sensitive to the Israeli soldiers. So let's take a look at this this next slide, the next video. So you can see the drone. This is their Avada's drone. This is they're come in case with these drones. This is one of the major innovations of this war for the Israelis, that they use these drones to case buildings, and they use them all the time. So they send them in. They don't have to send their fighters in. You can see the canine looking around in here. He's got a camera on his back. And like I said, we have to edit this out. But in the original video, these guys walk into the room one after another. And then Qassam detonates, as you can see there, destroying the camera, a successful operation that killed two Yahalom soldiers and wounded four others. And you can see the Oketz canine units. This is the canine units, according to the Israelis, have lost 45 of these working dogs in the battle in Gaza. He's got a camera and a radio on the dog, and they can communicate with their handlers. And so the dog apparently doesn't find anything in this room. So the soldiers come in one after another. And then the Qassam detonates the tunnel booby trap, and successful operation Gates of Hell Part 5. And this continues, this operation continues. The fighter says at this point here, we've hit you in one place and now we're coming for you in another. The fighters withdraw down into the tunnel and then move across the street and move to the reinforcements that come after the detonation of the house. The Israelis send reinforcements. You can see a Merkava tank here coming, and they, Qassam has now crossed the street and are on the other side. So they, this is the way the tunnels are used for 360 degree coverage. The Israelis believe they're in front of them, and you see an elevated Yassin 105 strike built in, anti-tank weapon built in Gaza, as I always point out, and no active protection on that one. We are seeing now a D9 bulldozer coming in to help extract, and he's going to be hit as well. So detailed, complex ambush, well planned, well executed by the Rafah Brigade, who the Israelis keep telling us are defeated, and keep sending us these series of operations that are remarkable. And people who have been following our show for the last year and a half had known the Rafah Brigade have carried out these ambushes consistently for the entire year. The battle in Rafah began on May 7th of last year. So they've been fighting for more than a year. We can see this next slide is the tank, the tank being hit by the Yassin that we just saw. And the scene ends with the commander saying, and finally, our message to our people and to the free people across the Gaza Strip, and especially to the people of Rafah, of steadfastness. Today, the branch in the tree stands before its deeply rooted origin, declaring, we promise and pledge we will remain here on our land, defending you and defending our homeland. So message from Qassam. From Gates of Hell operation number one. There's going to be three of these operations that we're going to watch today. The next one is Qassam. Again, the IDF will advance through the Morag corridor, as we see the setup here. And they're going to be hit from the warehouse that you can see. Again, they're marking the Morag corridor, and the orange line is the way they advanced from that corridor into those two buildings. We've edited out the soldiers who are walking to take up this position. They've got mattresses on their heads. They're walking in to hold this position next to the warehouse. You can see the number of them. They number, according to the field report, there's a dozen at least in this one position, advancing from the Morag corridor, which allows them to do that. So the corridor is useful in that purpose. Taking the corridor was not a military accomplishment for the Israelis. If we look at the next slide, we can see the Yassins here. This is the building that the Israelis have set up in. And now we're going to see the Qassam archers with their thermobaric tandem warhead Yassins that are going to move through this already bombed and destroyed warehouse right up and attack that position. That Israeli position in the building. The audio track on this that you can watch on Twitter is all gunfire. They're all emptying their clips, all the shooters. There's a platoon of Qassam fighters here all emptying. You can see the bullets hitting off the concrete. And then this is an F7. This is a fragmentation warhead. So it's an anti-personnel warhead that we've seen all throughout the war. Again, they're using appropriate weapons. They're using the same weapons that they would be using if this operation was on the first day of the war. So they fire on this building, and then they're going to move back to the tunnel and go back down into the tunnel, luring the Israelis into this warehouse in the same way that they lured them into Gates of Hell Part 1. This is Gates of Hell Part 2. And this operation was on May the 7th. So we can look at the next slide, and you'll see the same thing as the last one. The drone comes in. These are these Avadis drones with the propeller guards that work inside buildings. And you're going to see the two canine come in here. And you can see they don't seem to be able to smell the explosives that are set up for the Israelis. And I think that this is probably a product of the Israelis having so heavily bombed these areas that the dogs aren't able to distinguish between explosive residues from the Israeli weapons and from the Palestinians. You can see the way they run out like that. They're not, they don't usually do that. In any case, we watch 9 soldiers enter into this particular ambush site before they are again detonated by Qassam. The camera itself is destroyed. Showing you here the medevac helicopter. The Israelis admitted 2 more killed in this. There was 9 killed and 50 wounded in this series of operations. So if we, I'm one page behind here, but yeah, so we're going to go to number 3 here. Again, we're going to set up, we get drone footage. You can see the destroyed Rafah. More than 80% of Rafah's buildings were destroyed at the end of 2014, so before this ceasefire, before this part of the war. Again, we have to edit this out, but the Qassam has surveillance within spitting distance of these Israeli soldiers in this position. They also have closed-circuit television cameras on them. We have seen Qassam use these cameras. The cameras are set up in the rubble. The fighters are moving through the rubble. The tunnels are in the rubble. And they're able to carry out these operations. These operations happen because the Israelis, for the first time, are moving out of the buffer zone and into the built-up areas, something I've been telling you about for weeks when people said, why weren't there operations? And it's because the Israelis weren't moving out of the buffer zone. Here we see them built-up area, and they're immediately getting hit. So that was hit with an F7. Again, that's the fragmentation warhead. You can see the building burn. With that first shot, and then there's going to be 2 more RPG shots. You just saw one, and there's the second one, anti-tank weapon. And he's showing us that from his GoPro on his head, but also we're seeing the same building being hit by the closed-circuit TV camera. So just remarkable detail in these operations on top of the effectiveness of the operation. You can see the building is burning, and the Qassam fighters themselves are talking about how this is burning, which you can again watch on the uncensored version of it. 2 more soldiers at least were killed in this operation. This is the first part of Operation Gates of Hell. This is part one. Part two, this is an Al-Tanur Rafa, also an Eastern Rafa. So it's still the Rafa Brigade. We're seeing Eastern Rafa Battalion of the Rafa Brigade. You can see the soldiers moving into position. The Qassam fighters have eyes on them. And this when this Qassam fighter detonates this, he says that and the Rafa Brigade will remain a hell for invaders as he presses the button. Detonating the IED, it's an anti-personnel IED, so we know these to be television or Radia IEDs. This is the Israeli armored reinforcements coming. I had to edit out the soldiers on the side of the road, but they go down, clearly seeing these operations are successful. And the Israelis have to admit to these operations because there's multiple medevac helicopters for each of these. So all for the last 2 weeks in Rafah, there's been reports of medevac helicopters landing constantly. And that's what we're seeing here. The original field report of this operation talked about seven soldiers being in that position. And again, you can see the detonation of that filling the view of the closed circuit TV camera. So these are all operations against the Golani Brigade's 51st Battalion, which is the same battalion that the soldier was, the lone soldier, prisoner of war, was released from by Qassam just this week as well. Which we will see after this. Qassam's handover was not like the previous handovers of captured soldiers. They just did it with a single photograph. And here you can see Qassam shadow unit. We've seen the shadow unit. This is in Khan Yunis. He was handed over. So the soldier was captured in northeast Gaza across from Beit Hanun. And he was released in Khan Yunis. And we usually see these fighters, these Qassam shadow unit fighters, holding Tavor Israeli weapons, Israeli-made weapons that were captured in battle. We watched, I showed you a video several months ago of an operation from the 2014 war where Qassam came out from a tunnel at Nahal Oz and captured one of the X-95s, the bullpup rifles, from the Israeli soldiers, but we saw many more of them in the Rafah and Khan Yunis handovers where we saw captured weapons. And here Qassam is holding a foreign weapon, a Steyr AUG, the AUG, known better just as the AUG. It's also a bullpup rifle, which is showing that they are getting these weapons. They probably got these weapons a decade ago through the tunnels. So this war has shown us that Qassam has used its indigenously built weapons, but we have seen moments throughout the war where the tunnels have played a key role in building up the army over the last two decades. So this is the handover of that soldier, and it caught people's attention because the Israelis are constantly watching these details. It's the only time they actually watch what's going on in Gaza. So Qassam is readily giving these, intentionally sending these messages to the Israelis. So that's southern Gaza. And I just wanted to show you the map in northern Gaza because it has tightened as well in northern Gaza. And there was a number of operations this week in northern Gaza, particularly in Shujaiya, east of Gaza City. Shujaiya is synonymous with resistance. And as soon as the Israelis moved out of the buffer zone and into Shujaiya, they were hit. They were hit with half a dozen ambushes this week. More than 20 soldiers were injured in these operations. We're not quite sure if the Israelis are still being honest about their casualties at this point, but the field reports matched the field reports by the Israeli military matched the field reports for Qassam in these operations. There was a number of these ambushes that were taken in northern Gaza as well. Saraya al-Quds carried out a couple operations in Shujaiya. They also fired rockets from Jabalia The Qassam Brigade's Beit Hanun Battalion carried out a number of operations, three operations against the Israelis in the northeast corner in the buffer zone as well this week. And just to put a final note on this, I want to show you this graph from The Economist, who, along with The Lancet, did a study on the casualty counts in Gaza, which anyone who's been watching this war knows that these casualty counts have been low. The hospital system has been completely destroyed. The systems for finding people in the rubble, like civil defense, they don't have heavy diggers to get people out of the rubble. People are moving so often, displaced so often, that it's difficult to know exactly who's in any given house and now who's in any given tent, because now the Israeli massacres, more than 200 civilians killed in the last 2 days, many of them are in tents. That's who they're hitting right now. And I just wanted to put a note on this because our sense of scale has been just so blown away in this, the scale of this genocide. I just want to say that since the ceasefire collapsed on March the 18th, officially collapsed with Israel's massacre on March 18th, more people in Gaza have died than died in the entire 2014 war, more than died in Cast Lead in 2008, 2009, more than died during the Second Intifada in Gaza. That's just since March 18th. So more have died since the in any given time period of war since the occupation of Gaza in 1967, just since May 18th. So I just wanted to put a point on that to end the note on that, on the Operation Gates of Hell ambushes. There still may be more. There was two other Gates of Hell ambushes in the field reports that we may see coming up. But those three operations show you that the Rafah Brigade is still ready to fight. And each of the territorial brigades are all in the same position. Once the Israelis push into those areas, they will be met with resistance. The Israelis have promised that they are going to move into these areas. They intend to start the war back up once Trump returns from his gaudy trip to the slovenly Arab governments that are part of his grift. And if that is the case, we're going to see much more resistance in the coming days. So that is the resistance report for day 587 of this war.
Thank you, as always, John. So much going on, so much destruction and devastation. And, you know, and yet the Palestinian resistance hasn't surrendered, which is something that Israel and the U.S. have always kind of just assumed that they would, not just in the last 18 months, but in 77 years. So thank you for giving us that context.
And they will not surrender. And if there's any kind of talk about disarming Gaza, that's not going to happen.
No.
Ceasefire negotiations are going to be dignified for the people of Gaza. That's the responsibility of Qassam, and they took a chance. They took a gamble, releasing this American soldier, hoping that that would move things along in the ceasefire negotiations, but also that it would open the borders for aid, which is what they understood was going to happen, and hasn't happened yet, and doesn't seem imminent. And it looks like that Trump, that this was duplicitous and criminal by Trump.
It was a gamble, and with any gamble, there's a risk that it won't pay off. And I think it was a gamble based on things they were hearing and being told from the Americans, that a goodwill gesture of releasing this dual citizen who was captured, let's remember, from a tank while enforcing the siege of Gaza, who left his home in New Jersey. I've seen contradictory news reports. I've seen some local news reports in New Jersey calling him a New Jersey native. Others have said that he was born in Israel but moved to New Jersey with his family when he was at a very young age. But what isn't in dispute that as an adult, as a young adult, this person volunteered as a young American adult who lived all his life in the United States, volunteered to leave his country and volunteer for a foreign military that was enforcing occupation, apartheid, and brutality on people who had done him no harm. And that's, I think, important to say because of the effort to portray him as some kind of innocent victim in all of this. He was a prisoner of war who took that chance. And Hamas took the chance of releasing him in the hope that the Trump administration would make good on the kinds of things that were being heard. I was going to do a whole thing looking at, you know, some of the statements that were coming out of the Trump administration before his trip to the Gulf region this week, where there were people close to Trump, senior Trump advisors, saying that Trump wants the war to end. And there was a lot of speculation or hope that a ceasefire would be announced during this visit. And it's coming to an end with his trip, with Trump's arrival in the United Arab Emirates. And we actually have a video of him being welcomed in the United Arab Emirates that we can take a look at now. So that's Trump being received in the UAE by Mohammed bin Zayed, the ruler, and that was a tradition. That's apparently a traditional Khaliji dance by the women. And I don't want to mock anyone's traditions, but just the whole scene of Trump being welcomed and fawned over and treated like a hero and lavishing you know, investments on him while he is funding and arming a genocide is just so disgusting. Yeah. And we're almost at the end of this visit and there's been no announcement of a ceasefire. What there has been the lifting of sanctions on Syria, which is a good thing because those sanctions, by the way, were always aimed at the Syrian people. They were always calculated and intended to cause suffering to ordinary Syrians. And so anyone who wanted the best for Syrians should always have wanted those sanctions never to have been put in place in the first place, but certainly to be lifted. But the sheer hypocrisy that these sanctions were imposed knowingly to inflict suffering on Syrians when there was a government that the United States and Israel and its allies didn't like, and it's lifted now that an ISIS, Al-Qaeda regime is in power in Syria. And I don't mince my words about that because that's who Ahmed al-Shara, Abu Muhammad al-Julani is. He was an ISIS emir and a leader of Al-Qaeda who supposedly split from it, but for purely cosmetic reasons. Mm-hmm. And all the effort was put into rehabilitating the, what's the right word, normalizing relations with the new Al-Qaeda regime or ex-Al-Qaeda regime, if we're to be generous. In Damascus, Turkish President Erdogan phoned in to that meeting between Donald Trump and Ashara. We didn't see any similar public effort to end this genocide in Gaza, nothing whatsoever. It's utterly shameful that this is where these Arab regimes are putting their efforts. And just a couple of news items that kind of underscore this, that came out since we started the program. One of them is this news that, actually, let's start with the second one. Tamara. And that's the news that, let's start with the second one, Tamara. Did I give you the right one about, I'm sorry, I mixed up the link. So it's the first link. There we go. Let's stick with this. Yeah, so this news came out where Bassem Naim, a member of the political bureau of Hamas, confirms that the U.S. is still holding direct talks with the U.S. on ending the Gaza war. But what is there to talk about? Because the United States could end the war with a phone call. That was true under Biden. It's true under Trump. The U.S., Israel is entirely dependent on the United States to carry on this genocide. And so, I don't know, there's not a lot of point reading the tea leaves. If the U.S. wants the war to end, they can end it. So far, they don't want it to end, the genocide to end, I should call it, not the war. And so it's continuing. And the second story... did I give you the, I just want to make sure. It's not going to the right place, Tamara, the link. It's one of these live blogs that doesn't necessarily show the right place. But Haaretz is reporting, and I'll just read it. It's a brief blurb from Haaretz. Senior Israeli security officials have held meetings in recent months with counterparts from the regime of Syrian leader Ahmed al-Sharra, Haaretz has learned. The meetings are being held at the initiative and with the mediation of Qatar, which maintains ties with both Syria and Israel. According to a Middle Eastern source, the meetings have focused on initial contact aimed at establishing a channel for message exchanges and preventing escalation in the region, while Israel publicly maintains a cautious stance towards al-Sharra's regime. Qatar and other countries have conveyed messages to Israel indicating that al-Sharra is not seeking confrontation or escalation and that the suspicion towards him is unfounded. So this is where they're putting their effort in trying to get Israel to... And this is why, we've said it time and again, even an al-Qaeda leader, an ISIS emir is acceptable to the United States and to Israel, and they will talk to him, is because he's willing to abandon any pretense of supporting resistance to Israel's colonial barbarism in the region against Palestinians, against Lebanon, and against Syria. Against Syria, Syria is being bombed and devastated by Israel, and this new U.S.-backed al-Qaeda front is on board with that. And Qatar, which is supposedly a mediator in trying to end the genocide in Gaza, that's where they're putting their efforts, in making Israel more comfortable and more welcome and less opposed in the region while it massacres and murders and starves to death Palestinians. These are the priorities of these sick Arab regimes.
It's really frustrating as well how, you know, we saw this normalization with Israeli occupation and apartheid, and now Israeli genocide in Syria with the you know, the new al-Qaeda regime in Syria. We saw it coming a decade ago. You know, we said this is exactly what's going to happen. This is the reason for the dirty war against Syria. And, you know, there was a lot of people who attack that kind of positions as, you know, Assadists or whatever, or denying Syrians their agency. You know, and said, oh, you know, that's not going to happen, and came up with wild ideas about, you know, once HTS, later on saying once HTS gets into power, it would be ready.
Tahrir al-Sham, the rebranded al-Qaeda franchise that Ahmed al-Sharra heads.
Yeah, that Syria would be in a better position to resist Israel, whereas actually,
Jolani, they're handing everything over to Israel.
Yeah, exactly. It's the dismantlement of Syria as a state.
Yeah, and all of these Gulf regimes lavishing tens of billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars, at the United States, or at least pledging it in new weapons deals, and for what? I mean, for what? Yes, These are protectorates of the United States. These are vassals of the United States. But has the United States ever protected any of its vassals? We've said this time and again. Where is the South Vietnamese regime today? Where is the puppet regime the U.S. installed in Afghanistan today? Where is Hosni Mubarak today? U.S. protection and promises of protection have never been guarantees that your regime will survive. Where is the Shah of Iran? And to bank on and bet on American protection in the time of Donald Trump, where you don't know from one day to the next what this man is going to do or say, seems to me completely self-defeating, even from a pure standpoint of self-interest. But it's just also lacking in any moral or ethical content or vision or humanity to tell him. You know, they could have said, President Trump, we will welcome you with red carpets and girls swinging their hair left and right and music, but stop the genocide. We'll give you an airplane. We'll give you our $400 million flying palace, but stop the genocide. And to do all this, it is so distasteful and so repulsive to see, while what's going on in Gaza is continuing, what Asim told us about, what we saw in Nora's report. I'm expressing my visceral disgust at this traveling circus that we're seeing.
Yeah, I think that's how we all feel, Ali. It is absolutely repulsive that still no one is forcing Israel to stop its massacres and slaughters and the starvation that, as Asim said, everyone knows it's happening. Now what are we going to do? Who's going to do something about it? There are, you know, thousands of trucks that have been waiting at the boundary, you know, at the gates that Israel has closed for 75 days, and no one in the world, no regional power, no, you know, court can enforce any sort of pressure to open those crossings to stop Israel. It is absolutely despicable. I don't know where maybe, we go from here.
Maybe we can sort of wind down on a somewhat positive note. I just want to note that the Georgetown student from India who was was imprisoned as part of the wave of the Trump crackdown on behalf of Israel, the Georgetown scholar Badr Khan Suri, was released at the orders of a federal judge, as was Rumeysa Öztürk. We talked about that last week. And in both cases, the federal judges pointed out that the imprisonment of these individuals was a direct attack on the First Amendment and chilling free speech, and that therefore their release was necessary. So the Trump campaign of shock and awe, of cracking down on dissent, is now hitting the wall of the law, and
Mahmoud Khalil remains in ICE detention.
I was going to say Mahmoud Khalil remains in ICE detention. Yeah. We want to see him free. We want to see them all free, and we want to see students and everyone free of the fear of speaking out that this government is trying to impose. But those are good signs, and they're reminders that a lot of people came together to support these individuals who were targeted, who were singled out to make examples of. And those collective efforts, the legal support, the community support, the protests, have yielded results and are working. So that's another encouragement to us that however sort of dismaying these scenes are, that we are still strong and we're powerful collectively, and we have to keep that up in the US, in Europe, in the UK, where The repression is intense. I haven't followed it closely just because there's so much going on. But Germany has been following the Trump path too, targeting students for deportation because of their activism. And recently, a court in Germany overturned 4 deportation orders for students there. That's something that I know we'll be talking, we're hoping in an upcoming show, talk about the repression across Europe. But this just to point out that we can we can continue to push back.
Yeah. And we have to. Thank you so much, Ali. Let's take a look at the website. We have some incredible new features by our Gaza writers. We have news reports by our staff. That's Dave Cronin's latest. Germany's love affair with Israel looks absurd. So please go check that out. There's Khaled El-Hissi's feature right at the top there, the photograph of him with our dear friend Abu Bakr Abed in Jordan. Really moving piece. So please read the whole thing. I mean, there's so much. So definitely. And we just published yesterday a new standalone podcast episode. This was with Dr. Nadim Hadidin Crowe, who is a British Jordanian physician who has been kind of witch hunted and suspended by the National Health Service because he dared to criticize Israel's genocide in Gaza. A really incredible interview with him, so please go check that out. As always, sign up for our email list, subscribe on YouTube and Rumble and Twitch and all the things that we're on. If you can, please continue to donate. You can hit the Donate Now link. Ali, do you want to say anything about the monthly donors and how people
To say again, we appreciate each and every person for all their contributions, which includes not just financial donations, but sharing our work, the lovely notes that you write to us, the comments that you write during this live stream and afterwards on the various videos. We read them. We appreciate them. Sometimes you have fantastic suggestions and we take them. Can't always mention each and every person, but I want you to know that it really makes a difference to us, to our morale and the feeling that we're part of a strong community that supports one another. And we feel the love and we're so grateful for it. And we're so grateful for the impact that you're all having by sharing our work. And we're just grateful to everyone who can make a donation and who does. It's what keeps our work going. And especially to those who give a monthly gift from as little as $5 a month to the sky's the limit. We won't put a limit on it. And you can do that by going to the website and clicking that Donate Now button. And we're grateful for that sustaining support that keeps us here for the long run. And I want to mention Mary, Ahmed, Karim, Lauren, and Maria. We're just using first names, but we appreciate each and every one of you for your support.
Thank you. And of course, I want to thank Tamara Nassar, our director and producer, Ali Gerzon for social media, Maureen Claire Murphy, our senior editor, Michael F. Brown for fact-checking and copy editing our scripts. Thank you. And everyone at the Electronic Intifada, all the staff behind the scenes who are doing the you know, very arduous tasks of fact-checking very rigorously and our very, our infamous editorial rigor at the Electronic Intifada. Thank you to all of our editors and contributors. And on behalf of myself and Ali and Asa, John and Tamara, thank you all. And we'll see you next week.